informed and unspun. This is The Big Picture.
Hello and welcome to The Big Picture. I'm your host, David Hayes, and tonight I'm joined by a panel of Nottingham students to discuss some of the biggest world affairs stories hitting the news in the past few weeks. Over the course of the next hour, we will be discussing the protests against the Erdogan regime in Turkey, relationships between US and China after the Shangri-La dialogue, and the prospects of EU reform suggested both within and without the European Commission in the last few weeks. So if you have an opinion about any of that, then do get in touch with us. You can send us a text. The number by conventional phone to do that is 07762 212 434, or you can send us a web text for free from urn1350.net/listenlive. You can also tweet us. Our handle is at urn1350. In any event, we should probably get on straight on to this first debate, which, as I say, is about the protests that have been going on in Turkey. So we are now nearing the 1 week mark in a series of protests and other forms of civil unrest that have swept Turkey, being concentrated mainly in the cities, but not just in the capital of Istanbul, over what was initially a seen as a very heavy-handed police response to an environmental protest. However, the public has also been concerned over elements such as the perceived Islamification of the famously secular government, with bans on things like alcohol and restriction on women's reproductive and other rights. So amidst this concern, there's been much rhetoric on other sides. And I think the big question, the overarching question, is are the protests we're seeing in Turkey in any way related to the so-called Arab Spring that we saw over much of the last year in places like Tunisia and Egypt? Answering that question, we are going to have tonight's panel for this debate, who are
Hussein,
Ahmed,
and
Louis.
Okay, so welcome all. So, as I said, first question, is this in any way related to the Arab Spring? Louis, why don't you start us off on this one?
Is the uprising in Turkey related to the Arab Spring? Is, I mean, it depends how you define what the Arab Spring was. Was it a democratizing process across what is classified as the Arab world? I mean, what we've seen with the AK party at the moment is a very much an anti-democratizing process over the past few years. When they got elected, was it 3 years ago? I thought, well, you know, this might end badly, because famously Turkey is a secular state, founded in the wake of the collapse of the Ottoman Empire by Ataturk, and I don't think that the AK party is following in his principles, and I think that perhaps if they don't do anything about it to appease the protesters, we could see an intensification of violence and protest across the country, not just in the big cities like Istanbul, perhaps in the capital Ankara, but across, even in the country, and especially if it affects the troubled region of Kurdistan, we could quite see a Turkish Spring, despite Erdogan's declaration that it is not a Turkish Spring.
Well, I have to disagree with you there, because the people who are involved in the Arab Spring have a different kind of mind, I would say, to the Turkish people. I mean, the people who are outside on the street today, they have no allegiance to any party. They are just the regular, ordinary people. However, the Arab Spring, for the Arab Spring, I would say that they try to take Erdogan's example. That's the important point here. They try to take Erdogan as an example, but we have seen now that Erdogan is not the right example. Everybody can see it now. Most of the people knew in Turkey that there was a problem, there was a discontent already, but it's just that this has been a tipping point right now and people can't take it anymore. That's what I can say. So in terms of comparison to Arab Spring, I would say that it is nothing like it, because the people who are involved in it are different and they have different aspirations. I can state that to you.
What are the aspirations then of the Turkish people
at
the moment?
They basically don't want an authoritarian rule. That's what I can say. They don't want dictatorship. They don't want most people in Turkey, for example, if we talk about Syria and other countries, they don't really like Assad, for example. But they know if they help to get rid of Assad, they know who's going to come, because we have seen it in Egypt and other countries that it's not. I mean, that's the difference between the Arab Spring and the Turkish. What we want is we just want police violence to end. We want the right to express ourselves. We don't want to go into prison when we say things that government doesn't like. We just want to be able to protest things freely. That's all we wanted. I mean, that's why this protest grew in scale so much. That's what I mean. I mean, if the police wasn't that violent, it would have been a peaceful protest. Maybe they would be able to destroy the Gezi Park. I mean, that park is one of the only green places left in Istanbul as well. So that's quite significant. And people don't know what's going to happen to that area as well. So
I have the same idea with my friend. Everything started as a normal protest for the protection to Gezi Park. It was just for a couple of trees in there to protect the environment. But after that, the police showed a high, how can I say, in the night, they burned the tent and the excessive violence to the protest. And then, normally it doesn't start because our prime minister... provoke our citizens. Normally, government just got in the election the 50%. But in the other, if we look at the 50%, there's another 50% not have the same idea with our prime minister. So we have rights, we have opinion. The culture, we have enriched that with a different opinion, not only one opinion. If you just say, I will do this and no one... can't no longer prevent this to me to do this. No, something should stop this opinion. This is like not dictatorship, but we should feel that our opinion is also important in this country. We are individually important for ourselves. But he said we will built there a mall and a residence or something like that. But it's my friend said that's only place in Taksim, just green place. It started there, and he also said something about our founder to Kemal Atatürk. He said for him some really bad words for drunk man, and he doesn't respect our founder. And everything comes step by step. But this is just the last step for the people. To do protests.
Just before last week, the week before that, I think a couple was showing public affection in the metro and the underground in Ankara. So people wanted to protest against this. So they got. So what happened was what happened was that they were warned by the underground officials so to not show any, don't do anything, don't. Hold hands or stuff like that. So what happened was people wanted to show their they wanted to protest this by having a protest in the front of the underground station. But what happened was AKP supporters and came with knives and started to threaten people. I mean, this is like you are attacking people's lifestyles. I mean, they should not attack people's lifestyles. They should just let people be free. That's what we want, really.
Freedom means everyone should respect each other's lives. But I respect the people, but people doesn't respect my mind, my opinion. I don't understand that the people in my still the same idea with mine feel under pressure. But we can't feel the freedom free in my country. So that's the case. And one thing more, I don't know if you followed or not, to Reyhanlı in Hatay, the bomb blast and 50 person have killed by the bomb. And still we don't know who did it. And he just said Assad supporters did it, but we are not sure about it. Some suspicions about this issue because our prime minister tried to get in a war with Syria. That's the problem.
Okay, so we've had a text in. I mean, there seems to be a consensus around the table that this certainly doesn't seem to be about regime change per se, which was a big aspect of what we here in the West called the Arab Spring. And the text, you didn't leave a name, so we can't say who it's from. If you do want to be identified, please do give us your name. It says, is it not like the Arab Spring in spirit, in that the aim, the idea that something is wrong and something needs to be done is there? Is it fair to dismiss it as not related at all to the Arab Spring in that respect?
Okay, I'll start off then. What I see different to the Arab Spring is that, okay, initially in Egypt, we hear it from the people in Egypt, the activists. You can go onto YouTube and you can listen to them. They are saying that either the army or the extreme elements have taken over the protests and they've come into power now, and then they are discussing really crazy ideas as laws. I don't want to go into them because they are really crazy. So it's not that we don't want that. We are, most of the people are here, they just want more democracy. They don't want any attacks on their rights. They just want to be able to protest things without being beaten to death by clubs and 20 police officers, or there are civilian police, like they are. Okay, go ahead.
No, please, after you finish.
Okay, there are people who are police officers who are dressed as people, and they are going there provocating the protesters so that they can attack them. They give them a reason to attack them. I mean, it's just crazy. This is just crazy. We just want the right to protest, and we don't want any police force attacking us. That's all, really. That's all. I mean, but there's another issue here. There's a culture of violence in the Turkish cult. I don't know. It's like community. Like whenever there's a football match, there's violence. Whenever there is elections, there's violence. Whenever there's something, there's violence. There's violence against everybody. But I think these protests are making people more united. I mean, fans start to come together. People start to come together. Even like the nationalist people and the Kurdish parties are like, you know, they are seeing each other. They are trying to understand each other. That's what I mean. I mean, that's what I want to say for this point. Yeah.
Louis,
what do you think Erdogan is trying to achieve by inciting all of these protests? Because if he didn't react with such violence, then the protests might have died out. The issue may not have gone away, but he definitely would have. We wouldn't be seeing scenes like that poor woman that was tear gassed from close range when she was just, you know, walking there, or the guy that got beaten up who wasn't part of the protests. Why is he doing this?
Okay, this is not a new issue. This is not a new issue because, I mean, every time there's a May Day or any other protest going on, even like, okay, going back to the 80s and things like that, there has been a culture of violence with the state against its citizens. I mean, people are now seeing that the media is not showing them the right things. I mean, this is another issue as well. I should actually talk about this because this is quite important. The media wasn't showing anything until now, which people, because they start to protest in front of their offices. Like, for example, I can give the example of CNN International showing the events live, but its subsidiary in Turkey, CNN Turk, they were showing a documentary about penguins in Antarctica at the same time. I mean, this is really ridiculous. NTV, another, like MSNBC, other channels, every channel was not showing anything. So people had to come together on the internet and sort of organize themselves. That's, I mean, it wasn't led by anybody. He says, like, Erdogan threatens people. I'll find those leaders. They are the extreme groups, etc. They are not extreme groups. There are people on the street who have never attended any protest before.
Okay, I'm going to move the discussion on a little bit now. I think the two big issues that are sort of standing over this wave of righteous fury, if you like, that's engulfed Turkey, are respectively EU membership and the relationship with the Middle Eastern countries, in particular with Syria, where there's been a lot of tension at the moment. So let's deal with Syria first. Do you think this is going to exacerbate the Syrian conflict? Is it going to be causing troubles across the Syrian border? Ahmed, do you want to come in on that?
As I said before, aspect of our prime minister, he tried to get, he tried to do something about Syria. Normally, I just follow the media, and I think America doesn't want to involve this attack. And I think they just using for to our country maybe a little bit to do this, like, you know, not directly, indirectly. So in the future, probably now, you know, in Turkey, many Syrian citizens live. So there's, of course, there's some maybe in the future something rise. So
do you think perhaps that maybe in 6 months, maybe in a year, if the protest, if the current of protest doesn't go away in Turkey, that perhaps the government could start a war on Syria as a way of distracting the citizens from their issues?
Well, they thought about attacking Syria before. I mean, the issue is, well, what's going to happen after Syria is being attacked? I mean, because we see these countries, some of them, I agree with people being more democratic, and I agree with, it's just, but the media is controlling things. As I said, I gave you the example of Turkey. They are controlling things to the extent that the wrong people are coming into the power. Maybe I shouldn't say that, but it's just that we want people to come into power who'll give that, who'll give people more freedom. I mean, I don't know whether you're watching Syria enough or other countries, but I'm constantly following the events in the world, because I like to follow things, and it's also our neighbor. The thing is, there are so many extreme groups attacking, and no one actually, I don't know whether people realize the extremists that are out there. I'm not against any Syrian freedom movement. I don't want Assad to stay there, but it's just, are we going to get the better people there? That's what my worry is.
Of course, I'm thinking the same, but yes, the main problem, it's our neighbor, it affects our country, that's the case. But at first, we should think about our country, because something in between Turkey and Syria have gotten higher and higher, it affects our citizens. The first, we should get in to think about it. The secondly, if you think about Syria, of course, there should something change, but I think we shouldn't do this directly, because it's our neighbor and it affects me, and many people live in Syrian citizens live in our country, and you know that something happened on Hatay in case of that.
Okay, I want to actually speak about what's happening in Syria as well. I mean, there are people firing guns from our border. I mean, Erdogan has already opened the war against Syria. That's why I need to say this, because people may not know. There are people who are attacking from Turkey and returning to Turkey. There are like some people, not all of them. Some of them are terrorizing the locals as well. People are like, they are saying they are going to a restaurant and not paying for it, and saying that Erdogan should pay for it because we are his
guests.
We are his guests. That's what they are saying. I mean. And also they are showing guns around, and it's just, it could have been done better. If we want a democracy, we shouldn't just send really extremist people into the field to allow them from shooting from our borders to their borders. I mean, they were literally shooting from Turkey into Syria. I mean, and that was captured in live television. I mean, this is, yeah.
We should solve the problem first in our border. Then we should look at the, or neighbor or something, but we have a problem. We have a really big problem, big issue. I can talk in freedom in here, but in Turkey, in today, 37 people in Izmir now in the jail for like provocation on Twitter. I don't know why. They don't allow to people say their feeling, their opinion, exactly. And they said, I can say many, many things about it, but I don't know, maybe time.
I don't think we have time. Yeah.
And the vice prime minister said, we can cut internet if we want, but we didn't do it. What's the meaning of that? Internet? What? And our prime minister said, 1 million people waiting in their house, and I don't allow to go out. Because if I say, they can go the street And then what's the meaning of that? Civil war? What's the meaning of that? So it's just increased the tension. That's it.
Okay, well, maybe just like in a couple of sentences to finish off this debate then. We talked a lot about the problems facing Turkey, the problems of democracy, the issues that it's creating in terms of international relations. What would be the most important thing, you think, to end these protests in a way that's mutually beneficial for everybody in the country? What would satisfy them? If it's not about regime change, short of that, what would it do? Well, very shortly.
I've just received, like, because we organized a demonstration today on Market Square. Maybe you've heard of this.
Yeah, I saw it earlier.
Well, the thing is, I've received an email from the Joint Resistance in Istanbul. That's what they call themselves. And there are some demands that they are making. And do you want me to say them out? Is that okay?
Why not? Go ahead.
Well, first thing they want to say is that immediate release of all who remain in custody throughout Turkey. That's what they say. So please release all the people who are protesting. Mm-hmm. That's all they are saying. Two, those who attacked Gezi Park, which is the park that we are where the demonstrations began, those who gave orders to attack Gezi Park, resistance, and the resistance was all over the country because it's spread all over the country right now, and those who managed the attacks, those who stopped public from using their democratic rights, those who are responsible for casualties, they should all resign, they are saying, because in any democratic country, if the protest became to this extent, people would resign because of this. The third thing they are saying is that they want the abolition of the protest ban in major squares in Turkey. So they want people to be able to express themselves. Four, they want the Gezi Park to remain as a park, and they should government to be more considerate to people's opinions, considering green spaces. That's what they want. So this is what we are protested about. And I mean, basically, people want the police violence to stop. This is what they want, really. That's all what I can say to you.
I mean, these seem like basic demands that are very acceptable, and it's kind of shocking for a country that for so long has wanted further and deeper European integration and enjoys a very good relationship with a lot of European citizens to start taking this route, which is potentially very harmful to the Turkish economy.
I'm afraid we have... Okay, Hussein, why don't you give us your final thoughts?
I'll just say that, I mean, Erdogan has been seen as the guy that other countries were showing an example of... example for the Middle East. Now I think this has gone away now. His untouchable status has gone away. I mean, he's not the bastion of democracy anymore. He's not the example of democracy. I mean, people have been trying to say this years and years. Just recently, the leader of the opposition went to European Union Socialist Party's leader, and because he said Erdogan is a dictator, he wasn't given an access to a meeting. So I wonder what Swoboda feels now, the Socialist Party leader feels now. This is just a pin like, because it's happened just 2 weeks ago and now these things happen. I mean, I didn't hear a thing from him. I didn't hear a story from him, because European Union needs to support Turkey's democratic rights as well as Turkish people itself. Because, I mean, the world is becoming a unified place. Yeah. Sorry. So that people need to support each other. So that's what I feel, I should say.
Okay, well, thank you both for coming in, and thank you, Louis, for sitting in on the debate as well. Unfortunately, that is all the time that we have for this discussion. It's clear we could go on for hours and hours about this very interesting topic, and a very important one as well. We're going to leave you now for a musical break. When we come back, we'll talk about relationships between US and China following the last week's Shangri-La dialogue. But we're going to leave you now with Heat of the Moment by Asia. So stay tuned. Hello, I'm David Hayes, and you're listening to The Big Picture. It is 33 minutes past 6, so thanks for staying with us. We're going on now to talk about US-China relations, and specifically we're thinking in the wake of the Shangri-La dialogue, which was a security meeting between various major players in the world security stage, principally the USA, China, and the European Union, discussing the context of specifically Asian security at the Shangri-La Hotel in Singapore. And Sino-American relations have dominated that discussion. The focus has been generally positive about the changing dynamic between the US and the rising global influence of China. But a couple of points of tension have arisen, with the US Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel accusing China of aiding and abetting so-called cyber intrusions into US security websites and databases and things such as that. There has also been tension over the US's demands for full disclosure from the Chinese authorities over the Tiananmen Square massacre, which had a recent anniversary on June the 4th. And then there are broader issues such as North Korea and Syria, where US and China feel that they're in fundamental opposition with one another. In this environment, then, it will be interesting to see how the US and China's relations with one another are defined by not just this conference, but by broader global forces. Joining me for this debate, we have Louis, who was here before.
Hello.
But we also have
Seb Bench, first year politics student.
And the delightful
Johnny. Thank you, David.
You're very welcome.
I'll give you the check later.
There we go. The first question is, to what extent is the Shangri-La dialogue necessary? Has China risen to the power on the global stage where it's effectively able to compete with the United States? Louis, why don't you start us off?
Of course. I mean, China, on economic strength alone, deserves, you know, to be in the forefront of political discussions that concern a world topic. I mean, because quite simply, at this moment in time in the world, money equals power. I mean, if you look under every product, everything is made in China, made in Taiwan, as in the other China, without wanting to cause too much controversy. And I think that they are, you know, they've got such a potential as well to expand even further. And I think that's a big worry for the US, who have become rather lazy and in accepting their sort of, oh yes, we're number one, we're on the world stage. And I think it scared the US, and quite rightly, and now they're deciding to do something about it.
Okay, I should probably have just mentioned then, if you are interested, those numbers that you can text in again, 07762-212-434, by conventional phone. Sorry, I'll just go over that again, 07762-212-434. You can send us free web text, urn1350.net/listen-live, or you can tweet us, our handle being @urn1350. Seb, what's your opinion?
Well, China may not quite be at the USA's level economically, but they're certainly very close and rising quickly, and they may not be seen in the same terms of rival as the USSR in the terms of the Cold War, but they're certainly very powerful. And so I think it's absolutely right and necessary that there's dialogue between the countries. I mean, China, hugely influential, both economically, having so many exports and, you know, a portion potentially of US debt, and also in opposition on the Security Council on issues such as Syria, but also very key, we talked when discussing Syria, China's relationship there, North Korea. So certainly very important, and there are many issues in which the US and China are quite far apart on, so it's right and necessary that there's a dialogue such as this takes place to bring them closer together.
Johnny?
Yeah, I think I agree with the other two panellists. China has 1.6 to 2 billion people living there. You know, they've got one of the biggest economies in the world now. It's growing at a hell of a rate, if that's true or not. We'll see if it's not being falsified by some government agency or something. I mean, not to get into conspiracies. But, I mean, I do think that they are an international player now. I mean, you would be ridiculous and laughed out of the room if you were to say that they weren't. I mean, you know, as Louis says, their manufacturing sector is enormous. They generate huge amounts of wealth through trading out of Shanghai and things like that. It, you know, it is a world player, and I don't think that you would be taken seriously if you said it wasn't.
It was interesting, Seb, that you brought up the USSR, USA Cold War element, because if any country is going to be monitoring what comes out of the Shanghai dialogue, the Shangri-La dialogue, it is going to be the Russian Federation. There are still clearly tensions between Russia and the USA, as we saw last month with the capturing of a spy, the third he was obviously a spy with a title like that. He had a fake wig, you know, which, you know, didn't do anything for Russo-American relationships. And to see the other communist country, you know, that was that moniker that developed during the Cold War of China, a different brand of communism compared to the USSR, and also the Western power of the USA is definitely going to be of interest to Russia. Sorry. Go on.
Sorry. I was just going to say that, I mean, there is quite a lot of similarities between the relationship that America has with Russia that they have with China. I mean, they're not exactly the best of friends. I think that they're...
Frenemies.
Frenemies, yeah. you know, it's more...
Can we never use that word ever again?
Yeah, no, that's fine. I think that it's more the public pressure on the governments for the countries to work cooperatively as opposed as a government-led... work cooperatively kind of legislation. So they're being forced to work together, which is only a good thing the more they do it, if you see what I mean.
I think the good thing when comparing the US and China relations compared with Cold War relations is that the US and China relations seem to be far better. There's not the sense that they're kind of sworn enemies, but just are too powerful to go to war against each other. There's a sense that while there are great diversions, they actually at the moment need each other. I mean, the US needs the massive purchasing power and surplus of China, both to produce their goods and also to buy their debts, whereas China needs a massive consumer market of the USA to also, and the dollar to put its surplus in. So I think as China's kind of liberalized its economy, certainly in terms of market economy, they've kind of grown more similar in terms of needing each other. Still, politically on human rights, they are quite far apart. But I think as the Shangri-La dialogue shows, there's certainly a lot more common ground and room to maneuver and a closer relationship generally than there was during the Cold War.
Just a small point is there is, apart from the human rights issue, another sticking point is both of those countries' relationship with Japan. Because they enjoy a pro-West affiliation, despite being the most... furthest eastern country, and so we have seen a lot of tensions, Sino-Japanese tensions, over the past months with the islands, and also years going down the line. And Japan does have has its own problems, especially with accepting history, but I think their role in mediating this or their role to play in Chinese and American relationships will be very interesting in the coming years.
Just to say, very interesting, and brought up the Japanese-Chinese relationships. Once again, the disputed islands, which one of the things about the Shangri-La dialogue seemed to be that although China and Japan disagree still about the islands, the talk seemed to have been toned down from its height a couple of months ago. And also talking about Japan-China, it'd be interesting to see where the slightly newish nationalist government of Japan continues to affect that relationship, because his government seems to be taking that in slightly the wrong direction, in my opinion.
Johnny?
I also, in the same kind of vein, the relationship vein, I mean, we have to remember that China is North Korea's biggest ally. Alloy? That's a weird turn of phrase.
Sort of North Korea plus zinc.
Yeah. North Korea plus crazy, I think, would be the... Whoops. China has a big influence on North Korea, and probably one of the only big influences on North Korea, apart from maybe Russia has some say. But I think that America sees that as quite important, especially with its vested interests in South Korea.
Okay, we are going to have to keep this debate quite short, unfortunately, but I'll ask perhaps a nice wide-ranging question. Do you think China will still be as important a political player in 50 years' time, if not more important? And will the world be a safer place for it? Any thoughts on that, Seb?
That's a massive question.
That is a massive question.
I think it'll probably be more important just due to the fact that the economy will continue to grow, possibly overtaking the US. I think this perhaps premature talk of the US's kind of hegemonic demise, so I don't think we'll see it drop away as some have feared. But
like the British Empire.
Exactly. But I don't think it's going to necessarily continue to rise or suddenly accelerate to the speeds China is growing. So I think inevitably China will catch up. I think, and I suppose it's partly hope, that it will continue to liberalise both economically, but especially on human rights and politically. I suppose in which case there'll be less important. In fact, there won't be the great difference and dichotomy between them. But I think we'll see China become an even bigger player on the world stage as it kind of comes close to the US and perhaps overtakes economically. And it's hard to tell what kind of state China will be when it does.
Yeah, I mean, I think I roughly agree with that without looking into my magical crystal ball of future telling. I mean, one thing that it is, you know, good to bear in mind is that, you know, China isn't actually very good with human rights. They're not one of the nice, cuddly kind of liberal states in the world. I mean, would it be kind of idiotic to think of maybe a Chinese spring or you know, probably not in spring, maybe summer, I don't know, Chinese summer where...
Well, it's summer now, Johnny. What are you trying to say?
Well, I mean, maybe we need to... Well, not we. I'm not associating myself with this in any way. I don't want to get shot. But maybe protests in China will come into the front in maybe the next 10, 20 years to kind of force the Chinese government into a more liberal state like has happened or hasn't happened in the Middle East.
Especially if that was an odd noise I made there. I do apologise, listeners. Especially as since in the Shangri-La dialogues we had a mention of Tiananmen Square, and obviously a very big sticking point for the Chinese government. You know, if you're on Google.cn if you're accessing it from China, nothing comes up. Famously, and their internet censorship is a whole different kettle of fish. But I think in 50 years' time, I'm not trying to sound like Al Gore here, but perhaps energy crises might play a different role and a diminishing. I mean, China has huge coal reserves and other fossil fuels, whereas as does the US with oil. But I mean, we'll see how both of those countries will affect the supply to the rest of the world.
You brought up the environmental side of China. I mean, China's just built a kind of 10,000-mile water pipeline from the south to the north because they're running out of clean water to use for production and drinking. So, I mean, maybe some kind of water related problem might arise in the next 50 years
like
in China.
James Bond film.
It is a bit, yeah.
Isn't everything when you get down to it, though?
Yeah, a little bit like James Bond.
We are going to have to cut it short again, as I say. Do stay with us. We're going to spend the last 10 minutes to a quarter of an hour discussing EU reform. So stay with us and do keep sending on in texts. For now, though, we're going to leave you with Big Yellow Taxi by Joni Mitchell.
This is URN.
This is URN. We have about 10 minutes left before we have to get off the air to let the next show on. I should just say that my voice can go as high as Joni Mitchell's. I'm just not going to. Coming up then, we're going to be talking, as I said, about EU reform. This is in response to, this debate rather, is in response to a number of recent developments, statements by the President of the European Commission, José Manuel Barroso, but also a statement by our own Home Secretary, William Hague. Barroso has emphasised there is an urgent need for reform in the Eurozone, which I don't think anyone can pretend doesn't need to happen, but stresses that Europe will come back stronger, and has emphasised, in fact, in a speech back in May, that... the countries of the European Union member states should start thinking about the concept or the possibility, at least, of political federation, because whilst it might be, as he says, political science fiction now, within 5 years' time, it may well be on the agenda. So we need to be having these discussions. On the other hand, of course, the European Union has recently been forced to allow certain countries to defer the deadlines for their austerity cuts in order to ensure that growth doesn't completely go down the toilet, suggesting that the European Union may be faltering in its very austerity vision, driven vision of the European economy. To which William Hague, of course, acting in concert with the Prime Minister, who has this big thing about European reform, EU reform, in terms of relationships between particularly the United Kingdom and the European Union. William Hague has stressed that he wants a red card system by which any member of the European Union can effectively veto a decision of the European Commission, preventing it from coming into EU law entirely. So my first question then is, what is the appropriate future for the EU as a political economy? Are we looking at political federation, or is that a step down which we should not go? Seb?
I certainly don't think we should rule it out. I mean, the history of the EU and kind of European integration has been a stop-start process. So it's quite possible that the last few years when we thought about, you know, the death of the EU and the euro and thought we'd never get any further could actually be a blip, albeit a rather substantial one, in European integration. I think it's quite possible, perhaps promoted, that perhaps certain countries will seek further integration. It's certainly been said that with the euro, certain further, particularly economic and potentially political integration is needed to make it work. Otherwise, it's doomed for failure. And there certainly seems to be an appetite, perhaps not surprising, in the European Commission for that, given its kind of Commission's job to promote the common interest, and it tends to be the driver of integration. I think the real test will be how the European public respond to it. So far, it doesn't seem entirely positive, but I think we certainly shouldn't rule out kind of
biggest understatement.
Just underplaying it slightly, but yes, I certainly don't think we should rule out a further federalisation of Europe. Though I think if that we do go down that road, the most likely reaction for the UK or for many countries may be the creation of a two-speed Europe that's been talked about. Because I certainly don't think the UK would be interested in going down that, and I think the EU leaders would be hesitant about forcing the country out, knowing that it potentially has that referendum in 2017.
I roughly agree. I think. I'm all for federalisation of Europe. I think the more cooperation you can have, the less likely bad things are going to happen, as long as people are responsible. I mean, don't get me wrong. I understand that it's not always good and you get bad things happen. But federalisation, like the American system, for example, where you have political freedom up to a point and then you have federal issues which, you know, sweep over the whole of Europe, I think that that is a good system that would work well. As for William Hague's point about a red card, I think it's an idiotic idea. If people think that things don't get done at the minute, it would just destroy the process. Luckily, we haven't got anyone from the right in the studio today, so I can get away with saying these things without kind of being shouted at. I do think that we have to remember that Europe is in this position at the minute because of kind of rampant, unregulated capitalism. So I kind of don't like the right winning too many of these arguments.
I think, Johnny, what you've just said is basically what I wanted to say. it's all right.
It happens.
What do you, me and you agree on something? What a surprise.
I think the problem is this: the European Commission takes far too long. I mean, I say far too long. We should respect the democratic process through which it goes. And that leads to a long time to make decisions, and that's a facet of democracy that we have to accept. A red card system, however, as Hague suggests, would definitely not be the right way forward. The UK would be red carding things, you know, left, right and centre. Anything that doesn't affect, doesn't benefit its insular mindset that it has at the moment, especially perpetuated by this ridiculous Tory government who has
and
no
also the input from UKIP at the minute. I mean, you know, them pushing to leave Europe is just disastrous.
Well, unfortunately, in this circumstance, I have to play the devil's advocate. So I'm sure if somebody like Elliot or James or Luke were here, one of our right-wing regulars, they would say that the European Union, well, I don't want to say anything about URN, I don't want to put my job on the line, hobby. In any event, that they would suggest that look at the Eurozone. The Eurozone is a big instance of European confederation, although it's certainly not federalism. and it seems to have failed abominably. Put on top of that, look at the way that the European Union is run through the EC, the European Parliament and all of that, in this incredibly Byzantine, I think it's something like a 19-stage process. Surely when something becomes complex and overweening to that capacity, it stops being democratic because people can no longer engage with it meaningfully. Flurry of hands. Let's start with Louis.
Well, there's no disagreement that the EU needs a good kick up the backside, a reorganisation. However, the idea that it's not, you know, that the right has that the EU should then, because it's not working at the moment, it should be abolished in its entirety, is simply ridiculous. It is the way forward. It's typical Tory short-termism. And it is just not beneficial in the long run, especially as globalization, you know, is one of the most potent driving forces in this day and age.
I think briefly starting on the red card, William Hague's red card idea, I think first, although I haven't heard it explained or in fully as laid out proposed, it does seem to be a rather poor suggestion, as Johnny and Louis have suggested. And I think those proposed in favour, it should remember that it's not as if the national governments don't have any say in at all. The, you know, there's the council and the council, the ministers they work for that, which is arguably the most important part and certainly the most influential part of the EU. As for whether it's democratic, certainly there's, I think, to an extent, a democratic deficit does exist with the EU, but I don't think the red card solution's the system and the way to do it. I think you need to further strengthen the European Parliament and its powers, as has been going on kind of continuously, and also perhaps maybe a direct election of a European Commissioner. That's how you introduced more democracy.
Surely the argument that at the moment the EU is far too sluggish in its response is one of the best arguments for a federal system. You know, you have the local governments, which are the countries, and then a federal system to overarch the whole thing. I think that makes perfect sense. And to anyone who argues that, you know, things are not working now, people know that things aren't working now. It's not the finished product. I mean, it's kind of in late alpha, to use geek speak, let's say. I do think that it's important that we don't just kind of go, oh, it's not working, it's broken, we'll put it in the bin, because it's getting there.
Okay, unfortunately, we are going to have to draw things to a close here tonight, so I'll just leave with the message from Hussein and Ahmed, who were on the show earlier for the Turkey debate, that if you are interested in finding out more about what's going on in Nottingham in relation to political activity surrounding the Turkish unrest, you should go and check out the Nottingham Solidarity Platform, and we'll give you a couple of hashtags for Twitter on the blog. So go and check that out in the next couple of days.